And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and it's my pleasure to welcome Casey Sepp to the program today. Casey is a writer of nonfiction whose work has appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, and The New Republic, among others. We'll be discussing her first book today, Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee, which is published by Knopf. Casey, Harper Lee cut her teeth in true crime by helping Truman Capote in the researching of In Cold Blood. How did she come across the story for the Reverend Willie Maxwell and the series of strange deaths that surrounded him?
Yeah, so Harper Lee actually grew up reading mysteries and Sherlock Holmes, and she loved a good crime story. And so, you know, right, she went out to Kansas and helped Capote with the Clutter Murder book that he worked on, In Cold Blood. But by the 1970s, she'd been looking for one of these stories for herself. And the Reverend Maxwell story, you know, was on the one hand an incredibly local and regional story, but it was also covered by national newspapers. And so much the way Capote had found the Clutter case from the New York Times, she would have been able to read about the Reverend Maxwell in the New York Times. And her sisters followed crime stories too. So Louise and her sister Alice, who I think a lot more people know about, were reading about the case in the Montgomery Advertiser and the Alabama Journal. And in addition to her sisters, she actually had a niece who lived in the town where the Reverend Maxwell's trial had been held and where the trial of his vigilante was held too. So she had a lot of points of contact for the story. And because of all the press coverage, she learned about it in the summer of 77 and could get down to Alabama in time for the trial of the vigilante that fall.
I actually found one of the New York Times articles online about Maxwell's death, and I was surprised on how many mistakes there were in the reporting on it.
Yeah, I don't want to take anybody to the woodshed. It is a tricky case, and some of the details were hard to come by. But yeah, that was a stringer for the Times. And actually, that writer was the editor of the opinion page of the Alabama Journal. So he was not in Alexander City when the Reverend was gunned down, and he had to rely on some secondhand reports. So yeah, you start to see why it was tricky for Harper Lee to write about this case. You know, the New York Times reported that there were 600 people there. There were 300. And the New York Times reported that the Reverend had been giving the eulogy when he wasn't. So she, you know, came to town and confronted right away a lot of misrepresentations and inaccuracies, all of which was probably frustrating for her because she was so set on, you know, an old-fashioned journalistic project where every fact was scrupulously reported. And that meant, you know, even reading the New York Times could lead you astray. So it's interesting that you went and looked it up. There's an incredible photograph of the Reverend. And so it almost certainly was a haunting story for the people who read it. But yeah, unfortunately, there are a couple of errors in that article.
So when you're doing your research and you're looking at newspapers of the time, how do you know what to trust?
It's a great question. You know, it's kind of an existential one. And I know that fact checkers lose sleep over this kind of stuff all the time. But in the case of that New York Times article, very straightforwardly, there was only one reporter present when the Reverend was gunned down. And so I felt that he was the most reliable source of information. In addition to some of the eyewitnesses, there was this reporter who was 21 years old, fresh out of college. He had just moved back to Alex City and taken a job with the local newspaper. And he drew the short straw, so he got sent to this funeral. It was a Saturday. You know, it was his day off, but he had to go cover the story. And he, of course, did a head count. So that's how I know there are 300, not 600. Although, you know, he and some other locals told me if you could have gotten 600 people into the House of Hutchinson funeral home where the shooting was, they'd have been sitting on each other's laps. There just wasn't room for that many. So sometimes you rely on that kind of common sense approach to fact checking. But also, of course, you're always trying to get as close to eyewitnesses as you can. And since these crimes took place in the 70s and Harper Lee's research took place in the 70s and 80s, I was pretty lucky that quite often I could just find someone who was there or who talked to her or who witnessed these things or who knew the Reverend. And in most cases, you're adjudicating, you know, minor discrepancies between eyewitnesses. But certainly when you're looking through old newspapers, you got to be careful because, you know, on the one hand, there can be inaccurate reporting. On the other hand, there can just be, you know, the biases and the stereotypes of the time. And another kind of hazard of this case is obviously a life like Harper Lee's. You know, she was from an upper class family and her father actually owned and ran a newspaper. There's just a lot more documentation. And the newspapers of the time were devoted to lives like that. So when you're looking into, you know, a marginal life like the life of the Reverend Willie Maxwell, you've got to go beyond the newspapers. You know, the archives can't tell you everything you want to know about those kinds of lives. And, you know, whole classes of people were just ignored by posterity. And you really do have to go digging through oral histories and get to know people so that you can learn about what life was like for them.
Oftentimes, with Jim Crow being the rule of the day, that African-Americans, basically a birth certificate and a death certificate was all that marked their official time here on our earth. So how do you go and research this person who probably doesn't have a whole lot of paper on him?
Yeah, it's interesting with the Reverend Maxwell. So you're right, he was born in 1925 in a small town in Alabama, in one of the most rural counties there, Coosa County. So you're right that, you know, the kind of official records you can go and find are a birth certificate and a death certificate. And some of the court documents are segregated, but you can go and look at a mortgage record and some of the tax records. So there's that kind of official paperwork. But as was often the case, one of the great equalizers and to some extent, you know, sources of opportunity for Black folks in this country was the military. And in the case of Reverend Maxwell, there's also some military documentation. He actually had a fairly distinguished service career during World War II. And, you know, I could see where he shipped out to and where he trained and where he was sent during the Second World War. So there's a little bit of documentation there. And then, of course, like a lot of crimes, once he was accused of crimes, there's a kind of robust newspaper record. But when you're looking beyond that, you really have to rely on people who were born and raised in the same place and had similar experiences, because they can tell you what the schools were like at that time for African-American citizens. And they can tell you more about Black churches, some of which, you know, were torn down or which don't survive. So you have to go looking for living, breathing sources. And it's an oral history within a community like that. So it does take a little bit more reporting to bring those kinds of lives to life. And I hope that, you know, even for people who might know something about this case or this part of Alabama, there's more for them to learn and a kind of richness that was flattened out in the contemporaneous coverage of the crimes. Because, of course, like any murderer, you know, the Reverend Maxwell had a life before those murders. And like any murder victim, you know, he had friends and family, and their stories weren't always recorded in the obituary or in the coverage of his murder. So, you know, looking beyond autopsies and death certificates and life certificates, I feel like is one of the real responsibilities of a reporter, because you want to give everyone humanity and let everyone kind of come to life on the page. So I tried very hard to do that. And the truth is, Coosa County and this part of Alabama is tremendously beautiful. And even, you know, marginal lives like Black sharecroppers in the 20s and 30s were rich and wonderful and had a kind of pattern and rhythm to them that's worth sitting with and getting to know and thinking about what they grew and the seasons of their lives and what their religious life was like. And so I think, you know, if you can go beyond the kind of newspaper record, you can sit with lives like that. And I hope that that's the experience readers have, that they don't just sit with Harper Lee, they sit with the Reverend Maxwell too.
Alexander City, where much of this is taking place, is pretty much at the southern end of the Appalachian Mountains. And Harper Lee came from Monroeville, which is a lot flatter and mm-hmm. further south. Did part of her problems in accessing beyond African-American people who she didn't know well personally, did just kind of the difference in those regions make a difficulty for her?
I mean, it's a great question. And, you know, regionalisms are fascinating for me. And I kind of love the phenomenon of microclimates and micro distinctions. And I think the first time I ever really encountered that in the South, I was over to Raleigh, North Carolina, and living there for a little while. And someone told me I was living in North Raleigh. And the idea that there was a North Raleigh was news to me, but of course they were right. And no matter where you live, you have opinions about the other people who live around you, and you know the ways in which life is shaped by, you know, the natural environment or the kind of small town politics or regional politics. And so you're right to point out that even though Harper Lee was born and raised in Alabama and spent much of her adult life there, she was from a different part of the state than where this all took place. And, you know, not that it was a tremendous barrier to entry, but there was a barrier. And, you know, the crops that are grown are different and the political climate is a little different. She would have had some learning to do, although she did come armed with a tremendous knowledge of Alabama's history. And I think one of the most interesting things she encountered in this part of Alabama was even more of the contextual history of the Creek Empire. And she was very interested in indigenous history and, you know, had grown up learning about what Andrew Jackson and the American Army did to the Creek Nation. And actually, the title of my book is from a lecture she gave on Alabama history. And She was particularly obsessed with the Battle of Horseshoe Bend, which took place not too far from where these murders had happened and just a ways up the Tallapoosa River. And it is considered kind of the definitive loss of the Creeks. And Andrew Jackson prevailed there, and tremendous loss of life. And the few survivors actually were rounded up and sent to Mississippi. And that was the beginning of the Trail of Tears. And so it's truly a definitive moment in the history of the Creek Empire. And she would have come armed with that knowledge because she loved reading about the Creeks and the early years of Alabama statehood. So she came with some knowledge. And of course, you know, she came with an accent that was a little bit of a shibboleth that would have gotten her inside living rooms and front doors just the way that, you know, her manners and courtesy had helped Capote out in Kansas. And, you know, the other thing she had going for was her niece had married a local boy from Alex City, and they had been running a motel. It's actually one of the places she stayed when she was working on this true crime project. So, you know, she had family there and she had some friends there. And it seems like, from what people told me, she found her sea legs pretty quickly and she was able to make sense of life in Coosa and Tallapoosa County, however different it was from Monroe County, where she was born and raised.
Going back to the late 60s and early 70s, what kind of town was Alexander City like?
Yeah, it's a very different town then than it is today. You know, truly at that time, the textile industry was just fueling prosperity and opportunity. And so the Reverend Maxwell would have worn a uniform that Russell Mills, this big textile mill in town, made. And when he came back from the war, he went to work for them. And the lawyer at the heart of my book was actually did a lot of lawyering for Russell Mills. And, you know, it was kind of a company town, and thousands of people worked at the mills these three-shift days. And if you weren't working directly on the milling floor, you were working in a Russell school or you were working at the Russell Hospital. And that industry, you know, could take cotton from raw cotton all the way to the end of the textile production. And, you know, they were making teddies in their early years, and then they were making athletic gear by the time Harper Lee was there in the 70s and 80s. And that was pretty much what a lot of people in town did. And that has all changed now. You know, that industry has moved to Latin and South America, and there's a lot less opportunity in Alex City today. But when Harper Lee was there in the 70s, you know, people were really living high on the hog. There was a big country club, and there was a tremendous middle class, and, you know, lawyers and doctors just flourished there. And the Russells, you know, again, had a school, had a hospital, and provided a kind of civic infrastructure that meant life was pretty good for a lot of people there.
What was Reverend Maxwell's reputation in the area like before his wife died?
Sure. So he was pretty well known and pretty well regarded. He was a Baptist minister, and he'd been ordained in the Baptist church. And that was partly because he had a gift for preaching, and he was called to the ministry. And, you know, his eloquent way of speaking was very well known, and his distinctive sartorial choices were very much admired and talked about. So he really was well regarded. And he never had a full-time parish call, but he did itinerant ministry. And, you know, he might preach at one church this Sunday and another church next Sunday, and he would do funerals and marriages and baptisms and that kind of ad hoc ministry. But he was in high demand because people admired his preaching. And in addition to that, he worked at the mill and he worked at a rock quarry, and he did something called pulpwooding, which is the kind of short logging part of the logging industry there. So, you know, he would go out into these forests and cut 8-foot sections of log that would then be taken to pulpwooding mills. And so he was very well regarded for his work ethic and for his eloquence. And that all changed in 1970 when his first wife was found murdered and he was accused of her murder. And pretty quickly his reputation changed and the sordidness of his life. So he'd had a few extramarital affairs and had an illegitimate daughter he'd legitimated, that information started to spread and his reputation changed. But prior to 1970, he was very well known and very well regarded.
So how did this man of God make his way from homilies to homicide?
Boy, I mean, that's putting the matter plainly. And the truth is, it's one of the real mysteries of this case. So his first wife was found murdered, and her autopsy file is pretty graphic and pretty detailed, and there was a cause of death determination, and that's why he went to trial for that murder. Now, he was acquitted, but subsequently, there were four other members of his family who were found dead under suspicious circumstances. And in some of those instances, the crime lab for the state of Alabama couldn't even make a cause of death determination. So, you know, on the one hand, the Reverend was never convicted. On the other hand, every one of these deaths was followed by some pretty lucrative insurance payouts. And the motive seemed pretty clear to the investigators that he'd held life insurance on all these individuals, and the MOs around the various deaths were so similar that it seemed like it could hardly be coincidental. So the method, though, was not always determined. And, you know, there was rumor and there was suspicion and there was innuendo, but there was very little proof. And so that's why he was never convicted of any of these crimes, and why ultimately he prevailed in getting almost $500,000 in today's dollars of insurance money on these individuals.
So a lot of the insurance companies did refuse to pay out on some of these policies. Why did people keep writing policies for
him? They tried to. I should say they tried to. And the Reverend had the same lawyer for about 10 years of his life. And that lawyer had to bring over a dozen civil cases because the insurance companies would try and say no, but then they would sue him in court. And quite often the Reverend prevailed. But it's a very different time for life insurance. And, you know, the truth of the matter is, if anybody listening was alive in the 1970s or old enough to take out a policy, they might remember that it was very easy to do. And if you had a social security number for someone and you had a correspondence address and you had 10 cents, 25 cents, a dollar, you could take out some of these low denomination policies, $1,000, $3,000, $5,000. And there was very little regulation. There was very little oversight. Medical examinations were often not undertaken. So, you know, I could call up the insurance guy and take out a policy on you without you ever knowing. You know, if you read magazines back then or newspapers, there would be these little tear sheets. Or if you went to a bar, there would be a matchbook you could pick up and fold over the matchbook and, you know, write your name, your correspondence address, and somebody else's social security number, and there was your policy. You know, it was easy to do. And beyond that, in the 70s, one of my favorite stories when I was researching all of this is you could go into an airport, and before you got on your flight, you could put a quarter in a vending machine and get a policy for the duration of your flight. And, you know, all of this stuff continued until people got caught committing fraud. And so in the case of the airplane policies, you know, somebody bombed a plane and tried to collect life insurance on all the passengers. And that meant, you know, those regulations were changed. And you had men like the Reverend Maxwell who succeeded in making all this money on these policies. And, you know, the various states started to regulate the industry more strictly. And so you had to have an insurable interest on someone. And that meant, you know, you had to have a good reason for keeping them alive in order to take out the policy. So you had to be a spouse or a sibling or something like that. And the insurance companies started to do medical examinations to make sure that, you know, nobody had terminal cancer before they took out the policy, or that, you know, when you called up to complete the medical exam, you were aware that so-and-so was taking out a policy on your life. And all of that, you know, if other things hadn't put an end to the Reverend's insurance mill, those regulations and changes would have done so. But at the time he was doing this, it was just tremendously easy to do. And if folks have ever seen, you know, The Postman Always Rings Twice or Double Indemnity, you know, when I saw those movies years ago, I just thought, oh gosh, you know, wild screenplays and, you know, fictional scenarios, but they're basically documentaries. You know, it was very easy to do and there was a tremendous amount of fraud and the industry struggled to catch up with people's entrepreneurial spirit. So that's how the Reverend could do this. And there was no centralized database. So, you know, if you were doing these small policies with a dozen different companies, how are they supposed to know you had 17 insurance policies on your wife, which is what he had on one of his wives? And a few of the companies caught on, and there's a section of the book where I kind of get into what they tried to do to stop payment and to terminate those policies. But for the most part, you know, it was the Wild West. It was extremely easy to take them out and easy to cash them in if the person died, whether it was homicide or not.
Especially in the South, so many African American men were convicted of crimes they never committed. How could they not convict this man?
Sure. This is a great question. And I felt like it was one of the things I had to account for in the book. And I think that some readers might come with skepticism and just think, well, these, you know, crimes weren't investigated properly. And, you know, there were autopsies in all of these deaths. And there was quite a lot of toxicology work undertaken to try and figure out how these people had died. And it is curious that the Reverend was never convicted, because to your point, there were plenty of juries eager to convict Black defendants of crimes they hadn't committed. And certainly in these instances, they might have done well to convict the Reverend Maxwell. But I can answer that question as it pertains to at least one of these crimes. And very straightforwardly, the next door neighbor who was going to be the state's star witness. She was supposed to testify that the Reverend had been out all night when his first wife was found murdered, and she surprised the prosecution when she didn't do that. Instead, she gave him an alibi, and, you know, people really couldn't figure out why that was. And a few months later, her husband died, and a few months after that, she became the second Mrs. Maxwell. So in that instance, you know, the state was really between a rock and a hard place. You know, they had evidence. They supposedly had a witness who was going to make it less than likely that he had not been the one to commit the crime, but she changed her testimony. So it was not always the failure of the police. You know, he was an entrepreneurial man. And he walked into his lawyer's office more than one time and said, you know, not to worry because there would be no evidence. So, you know, he was deliberate, methodical. You know, some people would tell you, well, he was innocent and that's why he was never convicted. But I think to really answer your question, you know, there's a pattern of criminality here and, you know, he knew what he was doing and he got better at it as time went on.
So how could his attorney, Tom Radney, keep representing him over all these years after it being pretty apparent that something unsavory is going on?
Yeah. So Tom Radney is, I think, one of the most interesting characters in the book. And the structure of the book is basically the first third is about the Reverend and a portrayal of his life and what happened and what he was accused of. And the second part of the book is about Tom Radney. And long before he was notorious as the Reverend's lawyer, he was notorious for his politics. And he was a Kennedy liberal in the Wallace years of Alabama's history, and he served in the state legislature, and he ran for lieutenant governor, and, you know, he had sky-high ambitions, but he was not a good fit for that time and place. And once his political career had kind of settled down, that's when he went back to small-town lawyering, and he was pretty well known as a criminal defense attorney. He was a great trial lawyer, and, you know, if you were accused of a crime in Alexander City, Tom Radney was the lawyer you wanted. So that's how, you know, on the one hand, he came to know the Reverend Maxwell. He was, even though he was a white lawyer, he gladly worked with black clients. And, you know, his progressive politics meant that he, in many instances, provided not only a strong defense, but a just capable representation for black clients. And so he had worked with the Reverend for a few years before the Reverend was ever accused of murder. He'd handled some deed transfers and mortgage transactions and a few kind of logistical things like that. But then he defended the Reverend in 1970, and then until 1977, he represented him in all these criminal and civil cases. And, you know, I think that a lot of lawyers who've talked to me about this book know perfectly well why Tom Radney provided that representation, which is when you're a lawyer, it's what you do. And when clients need a defense or anything else, you offer it to them, and you don't draw distinctions between one client and another, and you don't predicate your representation on someone's innocence. You know, if lawyers did that, it'd be pretty hard for some people to find a lawyer. So that was Tom, and he rarely turned down cases. And once he was working with someone, he continued to. So I think that's the kind of logistical explanation. But I think what's more interesting about Tom and the reason he's such a central character to the book is having defended the Reverend for so many years, when the Reverend was gunned down at the funeral of his last alleged victim, Tom then defended the vigilante who murdered him. So Tom is this tremendous character in the book because he then becomes the defense attorney for the man who murdered the Reverend. We follow his work in that trial as well.
So how did then Tom Radney get the idea to contact Harper Lee?
So that's one of the kind of, you know, tricky points to nail down in the book. Tom died in 2011 and I never got to interview him, but over the years, sometimes he said Harper Lee had contacted him, and sometimes he said that he had contacted Harper Lee. And the truth is they'd met once in 1976. They were both at the same party. The Democratic National Convention that year was up in New York City, and Tom went up, and Harper Lee was living there, and a friend of hers was having a party for Jimmy Carter, and she went to this party, and so they were both there. And in all likelihood, they met then. But Harper Lee, again, had all sorts of other ways into this case, and her family was following it, and she read the Times. So it's not clear that Tom is the one who contacted her. And in fact, she came down and sat in on that trial under her own auspices, and she got her own copies of the court transcript and, you know, did a lot of reporting outside of her connection to Tom Radney, but certainly he became a critical source for her while she was in town. And because he had worked with the Reverend over so many years, he had a tremendous cache of materials to give her related to those other cases. But, you know, again, she made contact with a lot of people while she was in town, other attorneys who had worked those cases, law enforcement officers who had conducted some of the original investigations. She got to know, again, the court reporter, the judge. She interviewed friends and family of the Reverend's victims. And, you know, she really got around town. So it's not as if Tom was her only point of contact on the case, although he was a tremendous source for her.
So how do you think her working with Capote in the research in Cold Blood informed the way she approached this case?
Well, I think for a long time I just had a theory, and then actually one of the most rewarding kind of archival finds in the course of reporting the book was proof of that theory, which is basically the In Cold Blood work was a template. And, you know, beyond kind of doing what she'd done out in Garden City and Holcomb with Capote, you know, getting these documents, interviewing witnesses, getting to know the folks who had worked in the criminal and judicial system on some of the earlier cases, she also just matter-of-factly had the same kind of note-taking structure. And so if folks are interested in this, you can go to the New York Public Library and you can look at over 100 pages of notes that she made for Capote. And when you go through the microfilm or you look at the original pages, you know, in the upper right corner or the upper left corner, she would write down the date. And under that, she would tell you where they were or who they were interviewing. And below that, she would make notes about, you know, what they said or what they looked like or, you know, questions she asked them or dialogue they delivered. And in the case of crime scenes or kind of set pieces, for instance, when she and Capote toured the Clutter House for the first time, she drew maps and made annotations. And she seems to have done exactly the same thing in Alexander City in the 70s. So there's a page of her notes from her work on this true crime project. And same thing, they're dated January 12th, 1978. She tells you she's interviewing the sister of the first Mrs. Maxwell. She tells you that woman's name. She tells you that woman's husband's name, that she was in their home, some of what they said, some of her impressions. And so we get, you know, one page that evidences the kind of symmetry between these two projects and shows that she was undertaking the same kind of, you know, nonfiction reportage that she had helped Capote with in Kansas.
Was there any record of how she felt about his deviations from the strict truth in Cold Blood?
You know, having been there for much of the reporting, and I think if folks have seen Infamous or Capote, they're aware that, you know, she went out to Kansas not just once in 1959, but several times over the course of Capote's years working on In Cold Blood. And she got to know people there and maintained friendships with the Deweys and the Hopes. And, you know, so she had her own exposure to this case and her own opinions about what had happened. She was with Capote when he interviewed Hickok and Smith. And I think at the end of the day, was very surprised by the book that he put together. And the reason we know that is, again, with those friendships she maintained, there's a lot of correspondence from her about what the book was like and her opinions of it. And to my mind, some of the most interesting correspondence are these letters that she wrote to Capote's fact checker at The New Yorker, who, you know, fact checked. In Cold Blood ran in a series of four articles in The New Yorker, was serialized before it came out as a book. So there was a fact checker at the magazine who knew perfectly well which parts of it were exactly factual and which parts of it were not evidenced by the reporting that Capote had done. And so Lee writes these letters to the fact checker and despairs of the book and, you know, expresses her objections to some of the exaggerations and fabrications and, to my mind, articulates what is a very straightforward notion about the difference between fiction and nonfiction. And, you know, In Cold Blood is, on the one hand, an extraordinarily beautiful aesthetic object. It's a beautiful book. When you read it, the language is extraordinary. The description is vivid. The writing is spectacular. On the other hand, it pioneered the genre of true crime where not everything is exactly factual. And, you know, look, reporting is difficult. And we were just talking about the New York Times article. And, you know, I'm sure there are inaccuracies in my book. And those come about because, you know, certain things can't be known or someone misremembers or, you know, you get a number wrong from a particular court document or something like that. But in the case of In Cold Blood, the things Harper Lee objected to were kind of deeper choices. And that was about, you know, the nature of guilt and innocence. And that was about, you know, scenes which had not happened, which Capote kind of structured or brought together or embellished in order to make a particular point about someone's emotional life or about, you know, their relationship to another character in the book. And those are the things that Harper Lee objected to. And those are the things when we think about In Cold Blood as a kind of watershed moment in the genre of true crime, she really had a problem with. And the work that she was doing in Alexander City seems to have been directly oppositional to that. And her stated claims when she was in town and the kind of, you know, opinions she expressed to sources and to people she talked with this project about, she very deliberately says, you know, this was an old-fashioned project and that it was going to be scrupulously reported and that everything was going to be factual. And that seems to be in direct contrast to In Cold Blood.
Now, speaking of The New Yorker, you wrote about this topic 4 years ago in The New Yorker. In that first article, then coming to when you turn in your manuscript, were there like any major revelations that you came upon that you wish you would have known for that original article?
Sure. I mean, look, very straightforwardly, I was at the mercy of some of those newspaper articles which were wrong. You know, so there's kind of factual information. A lot of people had told me there were no court documents and, you know, I would never get the autopsies. And once I did, very straightforwardly, there are facts that emerged there. But I think that probably the most shocking fact that I found that I didn't know at the time I wrote that original article for The New Yorker was that Harper Lee was present for the trial of Robert Burns in 1977. And there were a lot of memories of her around Lake Martin when she was working on this true crime project, but no one could quite remember when she came to town or the first time they met her. And no one could quite explain, you know, when she had arrived. And I was so shocked. I'd been told a couple of times that the court reporter who made the court transcript for the Burns trial was dead, and she turned out not to have been dead. She was very much alive. And when I sat down to talk to her, she had met Harper Lee during the trial. And Harper Lee introduced herself, and nobody recognized her. And that's a fact that kind of opens the book. But she was quite certain she had met Harper Lee at the trial because it was the day that Harper Lee arranged to pay her $1,000 for the court transcript and made the arrangement to come back and get it once it was done. And similarly, Harper Lee introduced herself to the judge there. And because it had been 17 years since To Kill a Mockingbird, no one really knew what she looked like. There was this outdated author photo. And beyond that, she was just, you know, a down-to-earth person. And so she didn't walk into town, contra Capote in Kansas, who walked into town in furs and, you know, making a big production of himself. She was down-to-earth and didn't look out of place and kept quiet, didn't sit in the press section of the courtroom. So nobody had really known she was there. So there were big revelations like that. And there was new correspondence. You know, I would never have imagined of all the people she would talk to about this book she was calling The Reverend, this true crime project, that of all the people she could have talked to about it, one was Gregory Peck. And of course, there are these beautiful letters that she wrote Gregory Peck in the 80s when she's a couple years into trying to write this book about her frustrations and the difficulties she was having with it. So that was another kind of revelation that I didn't know about when I wrote the article. But, you know, again, the difference between an article and in a book isn't always just shocking revelations. It's the chance to get to know an area and the kind of space to tell people a deeper story. And that's the real difference. You know, look, new materials emerged and new facts emerged. But the real difference, you know, if you read the article at the time, why I would tell you to sit with the book is you really get a deeper portrait of this part of Alabama and of Harper Lee's life. And, you know, and that comes from just really sitting with the history of these places and getting to know kind of the core themes that animated her as a writer and getting to know the characters that she was trying to write about. So that's the difference. You know, again, it's plenty of new facts emerge, new letters. There's, you know, a whole trove of material that I didn't have access to when I wrote that article. But I think the real difference is, like any book, it's just the chance to really dig into a place and dig into the lives of characters.
In structuring it with these three sections that are discrete for Maxwell, Radney, and Lee, how do you make it cohere and make a solid book unit?
Well, pretty straightforwardly, the book is a chronology. So, you know, the Reverend is the oldest of the characters. He's born in 1925, and kind of the book opens. I give you a prologue where I kind of put these people in the room together so that you remember Harper Lee's role. But basically, we sit with the Reverend through those crimes from 70 to 77, and then we pick up with Tom Radney, who represented the vigilante in the trial in 1977, and then we pick up with Harper Lee's effort to write about it. So there's backstory and there's prologue for all of them, but, you know, to my mind, the book is a straightforward chronology, and it gets you from the beginning of the Reverend's life to the end of Harper Lee's, and that moves you from 1925 to 2016. So it's character driven, but there is a kind of overarching chronology. But I think the more interesting question is, you know, why keep these characters discrete? And to my mind, you know, the Reverend, the lawyer, the writer, there's a reason I don't use their proper names when I introduce their sections. And to my mind, this is a book that looks at three very different ways of organizing the world and accounting for why things happen and the kind of order and structure we might want. So you have a Baptist minister, and so you look at the role of religion in a small town in the South, and then we have a lawyer who truly lived his life in pursuit and, you know, in evasion of law and order, and who lived his life in courthouses and interacting with the criminal justice system. And then we have Harper Lee, who, you know, as a literary writer, thought a lot about the stories we tell and how we make sense of our lives through a kind of aesthetic project. And that's why, to my mind, you know, it's on the one hand three biographies, but it's also just three very different ways of telling the same story and making your way through the world. So that's why it felt like they had to be distinct to me.
What in your personal life and your aspects of your personal life do you think that's going to prevent you from being a person that puts out essentially one book in their lifetime?
How am I not going to be Harper Lee?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, look, for the 4 years I was working on this book, everybody in Alex City and everywhere I ever talked about it would just say, you know, how are you possibly going to write the book? She couldn't. So I'm just glad the question has changed. You know, that matter is settled, although I would say this isn't the book she couldn't write. It's the book she wouldn't write, because it's the book that has her story in it and that kind of gets into the secret life of Harper Lee, as it were. But
she did not like people talking
about her. Yes, she had, you know, a real allergy to press and publicity and anything private. But why do I think I won't be Harper Lee? I mean, I loved To Kill a Mockingbird as a kid, and I loved the character of Scout, and my father wasn't a lawyer, but I was a total daddy's girl. And so I came into this with a deep appreciation for her writing. And I think in the way that, you know, we can over-identify with our heroes, I thought I had a lot more in common with Harper Lee than I do. And one very straightforward thing to say is I love writing, and I experience it as a joyful thing, and I feel tremendously lucky to get to do it for a living. And I love to sit down with a legal pad or my laptop and just get to work and play with words and try and write about anything. And Harper Lee is someone for whom writing was real misery. And she was a writer who truly valorized suffering and felt that the work was better for it, and felt that, you know, if you weren't struggling with your work, then it probably wasn't very good. And that is just not the way I think about writing. And I think I have a kind of, you know, just more mundane relationship to it. It's a job. I'm very grateful to get to do it. And it's not that I don't think literature can be transformative or life-changing, but I just don't think anybody needs to suffer to do it. And reading her letters over the years, you know, in the 60s, in the 70s, in the 80s, they're heartbreaking. And they're heartbreaking, not just these private letters, but, you know, the few times she went and did, nowadays, writers, fiction writers, we send them out to college campuses and, you know, they sing for their supper and they do these kind of dog and pony shows about writing. And I actually really love them. And I went to a lot of them when I was in college and just thought it was so incredible to get to hear somebody talk about their work. But Harper Lee did it very rarely. And when she did it, she just confessed this kind of agony of being an artist. And she would warn these, you know, these poor like college co-eds would just feel like asking, you know, what's it like to be a famous novelist? And she would basically say, you know, it's miserable and it's lonely and you have to sit alone at your typewriter. And she loved quoting this Gene Fowler quote about how you would sit down and bleed at the typewriter. And it's just not my experience. And, you know, it was heartbreaking to have to read about someone whose work you admired so much and to realize the relationship she had to her own work. So I don't think there's any danger of that becoming me, because it is just something I love to do. And I'm already thinking about book two, and I'm on the hook. And actually, I just blew a deadline for a piece I've got to finish, but the tour is keeping me a little busy. But I just love it. And I kind of can't stop writing. And I think, you know, it was a tremendous honor to get to write this book, and I'd like to write 100 more. So I don't think I have the relationship to my work that she did. And it is just a profound difference between us.
Can you share what the topic of book two might be?
Ah, can I share? I'm not under contract for it. You know, I can tell you this book came about, we were talking about eyewitnesses and tracking people down. And, you know, sometimes you're tracking down the second cousin of somebody's third cousin who might have a letter that Harper Lee might have written to somebody. And, you know, I have chosen for book two, I think, a topic that's a lot older. It's about a 16th century shipwreck. So there will not be any eyewitnesses. There'll be a lot of archival work and a lot of kind of interesting history to reckon with. And it is, in a way, a kind of true crime story. So I think most people would describe it as a treasure hunt, but I would say it's a theft. It's a story about theft. So it's quite different, but it'll keep me coming back and forth to the South. So one thing that's exciting for me is I think there'll be some research in Florida. But yeah, I just, you really feel for Harper Lee. And I think I thought the sad parts of the book would be about, you know, violent crime, or it would be about the kind of failure of liberalism in the South. And, you know, again, there's this kind of tragic political history to reckon with when you're writing about, you know, Alabama in the 60s and 70s. But as it turns out, I think some of the saddest bits of the book are just sitting with Harper Lee alone at the typewriter.
Well, Casey, I want to thank you so much for coming by and sharing your book with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Casey Sepp is the author of Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee, which is published by Knopp. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.